Chapter 19. Sense and Sensitivity. Shaking in terror, the young man clenches his teeth, forcing his screams to stay silent as giant talons seize his scalp, puncturing his head with pain. He felt the claws bore far down, crack open his skull, touch his brain. He's come again, he murmured, trembling. In The Last Temptation of Christ, his tender, tormented novel about the life and death of Jesus of Nazareth, Nikos Kazantzakis understands well the ancient sound of God. This is a deity whose voice is wholly unhuman, a divine word that rips into the flesh and bone of his chosen prophets and holy men, snatching them away like a ravenous bird of prey to carry them off to a hypersensory, otherworldly plane. It's a far cry from the gentle dove of the Gospels, fluttering above Jesus' head as a voice from the heavens declares, "This is my Son, the Beloved, with whom I am well pleased." In Kazantzakis' novel, the voice of God is the same razor-sharp sound that more usually clawed at his prophets in the Bible, an ear-splitting voice tearing its way through flesh and bone, assaulting mortal bodies with a noise so uncontainable and so violent, it is all they can do to spit out his words like blood. For Amos, the sound of God's voice was the terrifying, guttural cry of a predator mauling its catch. The lion has roared, who is not frightened? The Lord God has spoken, who can but prophesy? He helplessly asks. God's roar blasted out of the Jerusalem temple, scorching its way across the land with a fire-hot force. Yahweh roars from Zion and utters his voice from Jerusalem. The pastures of the shepherds wither and the top of Carmel dries up. The same ferocious voice of God burns Jeremiah's mouth, forcing him to breathe rhetorical fire on Yahweh's worshippers and devastating the prophet himself with the brutality of the divine attack on his body. "You have overpowered me, you have prevailed," he sobs. "Whenever I speak, I must cry out, I must shout, violence and destruction." The impact could be physically devastating for those around prophets too. As mortal vehicles of divine speech, the urgent screams of prophets savaged by God's voice ripped through startled, frightened communities, much to the deity's delight. "I have split them by the prophets. I have murdered them with the words of my mouth." In the Bible, the sound of God is concretely physical. Even when the deity hides his body from the world, his noise materializes, sweeping, rumbling, roaring, or reverberating through the earthly realm, disrupting any delicate differences drawn between the tangible and the incorporeal. It's for this reason that God's prophets are often said to see rather than hear the spoken words of the deity. And it's why the Israelite tribes assembled at Sinai are said to have seen the sounds of Yahweh's thunderous presence on the mountain. These biblical portrayals of sound were not unusual. The peoples of ancient Southwest Asia understood that sound is not immaterial. Although they framed the mechanics of noise in ways vastly different from the tech talk of modern-day physicists, who explain that sound comes into being in both its source and sensing through the vibration of something material, they knew full well that sound is an inherently material phenomenon, whether or not its source was visible to humans. The gods were not always seen, but they could be heard, and in being heard, their physical presence was known. Across the ancient world, the most primordial otherworldly sound was the boom of thunder or the roar of the sea. As loud noises emanating just beyond the edges of the mortal world, these were the sounds most naturally identified with the voices of gods and monsters around which cosmological myths were spun. One of the most vivid of mythological motifs was the shout of a storm god, whether he was raging in battle or bellowing his victory from his mountaintop throne. In the Levant, Baal's voice could be heard blasting through the open window of his new heavenly palace, installed on the sage advice of his builder, the deity Khothawahasis. Khothawahasis laughed. He opened his voice and cried, "Did I not say to you, O valiant Baal, that you would return, Baal, to my suggestion? Let a window be opened in the house, a casement in the midst of the palace. Baal opened a rift in the clouds. His holy voice Baal gave forth. Baal repeated the issue of his lips. At his holy voice the underworld quaked. At the issue of his lips the mountains were afraid. The ancient mountains were afraid. The hills of the earth tottered. This vivid mythic vignette hints at the anatomical mechanics of divine speech. The voices of the gods were physical entities with their own heft, properties, and dimensions. Stored in the deity's throat, ready for release, the divine voice was ever present and ever resonant, so much so that deities might talk to themselves without uttering a sound, much as Baal's adversary Mote, Death, does when he speaks to himself by calling out in his throat. By contrast, and as one biblical writer would put it, false gods were those who had no sound in their throats at all. Opening first their throats and then their mouths, the gods' voices continued to break through openings in divine space, a temple or the clouds, to make their way into the earthly realm, where their splitting force might cleave mountains, pierce the ears of mortals, and prise open the mouths of prophets. The sense that divine sounds were tangible, material forms was reflected in the idea that divine messengers could even contain and carry a deity's voice to another god or to a human, as though they were delivering a parcel, the original voicemail. But when Baal wanted to make his voice heard, messengers were rarely required. Atop his holy mountain, his booming voice was stored within his body, much as thunder, lightning, and rain were understood to be stored in heavenly vaults and chambers, ready to be released. Just as Kothar-Wahas's open, laughing mouth unleashed his voice, so Baal's open window in the clouds gave forth his voice, which repeats on his lips like the rolling rumble of thunder, shaking the earthly realm from its underworld foundations to the tops of its mountains. Not one to be outdone by his older cultural sibling, the god of the Bible would also utter his booming voice from his own mountaintop palace, a heavenly building similarly furnished with windows, so that when God thundered, the windows of heaven opened and the foundations of the underworld trembled. A more detailed description of God's voice occurs in Psalm 29, one of the oldest poems in the Psalter. Here, Yahweh sits enthroned over the defeated flood of chaos, while his divine sons, the junior deities, assembled in his palace, cry out in awe as his voice flashes, crackles, and thunders through the world. Convulsing everything in its path, the voice of God was a visual as well as audible phenomenon. The voice of Yahweh is over the waters, the God of glory thunders, Yahweh is over the mighty waters. The voice of Yahweh in power, the voice of Yahweh in majesty. The voice of Yahweh breaks the cedars, Yahweh breaks the cedars of Lebanon. The voice of Yahweh flashes forth flames of fire. These are the same fearsome sounds the Israelites are said to have seen at Mount Sinai. Here, the silent stillness of the wilderness is smashed apart by Yahweh's thundering voice as he lists aloud his Ten Commandments. As he talks in thunderclaps, the deity's voice generates flashes of lightning and ferocious flames, much as the Babylonian god Marduk is said to have kindled a fire when he moved his lips. Yahweh's body is hidden by a thick black cloud, while streams of smoke swirl about the mountaintop to the ethereal sound of a shofar, a ram's horn seemingly trumpeted by a heavenly musician to herald the deity's presence. The cacophony of cosmic, mystical sounds is quite literally spectacular, and so terrifying that the Israelites back away from the mountain, shaking with fear. "Do not let God speak to us," they beg Moses, "or we will die." The mortal danger posed by God's voice would give rise to a myth weaving its way through rabbinic expositions of this biblical story. The Israelites were so frightened by the sound and sight of God's voice, some rabbis explained, they not only backed off from the mountain, but ran and ran and ran some more until they all suffered heart attacks and dropped dead. The Torah itself had to step in. "Master of the universe, are you giving me to the living or to the dead?" Torah asked. "To the living," God replied. "But they're all dead," came the rather obvious response. God hastily revived the dead with life-giving dew from heaven, but the resurrected Israelites were still so frightened they could neither stand on their feet nor look up at God. Worrying that their hearts would fail again, God appointed a pair of angels to minister to each quaking worshipper, one to place a hand over each man's heart to keep it calm, and another to tilt each man's head heavenward so that he could behold God. The sound of the gods was supernatural not only because it was divine in nature, but because it disrupted the natural noise of day-to-day life, and daily life was already very noisy. Just as we're accustomed to the hubbub of the everyday, the chatter of human voices, the hum of traffic, our blaring screens and radios, and the pings and rings of mobile phones, so too our ancestors were used to a world in which noise was the norm. But a noise that disturbed, unsettled, or invaded the soundscapes of everyday life was a rip in the mysterious membrane separating the world of mortals from the realm of the gods. A noise sounding in spaces where it should not be heard was especially frightening and potentially signalled a divine disturbance of special significance. In a biblical story about the prophet Elijah, it's the wrong sort of sound that reveals the corporeal presence of Yahweh, but in a highly unexpected way. Across the Levant, gods were usually thought to have loud voices. They were, after all, superhuman, rendering everything about them bigger, better, and louder than mere mortals. But Elijah's experience is rather different. Like Moses, he is said to ascend the holy mountain in the wilderness, here called Horeb, where a message from Yahweh tells him that the deity will pass by. On his divine mountain, we might expect Yahweh to reveal himself in a show-stopping performance of thunder, lightning, and earth-shaking splendour. But the deity has other ideas. A ferocious stormy wind suddenly rips through the air, splitting mountains and shattering rocks, but Yahweh has not yet arrived. It's immediately followed by a tremendous earthquake. Still, Yahweh does not appear. Suddenly, there is fire, but Yahweh is not in the crackling flames. Instead, after the cacophony of noise at the mountainous edge of heaven, there is a quietness. This is not the sound of sheer silence, as some modern translators would have it, but a quiet voice. It's the sound of God, and on this occasion, this is how he chooses to reveal himself, although Elijah can't see him, for he's so unnerved that he has wrapped his face in his mantle, sensibly shielding his eyes from the expected dangerous glare of the deity. For all his bellowing and bluster in his more public appearances, Yahweh speaks privately to his prophet, in a whisper. It's an image of intense intimacy as a gigantic deity, whose physical approach had shattered and burned the mountaintop, murmurs softly into the prophet's ear. But it may be that Yahweh rather enjoyed the opportunity for quieter moments like this, for the divine realm itself was a noisy place. Selective hearing. Long before the devil came to have the best tunes, the God of the Bible was listening to music and song. Praise Yah, in Hebrew, hallelujah, was the repeated, rapturous refrain on the lips of his worshippers, and sing his praises they did, taking their lead from the junior gods in Yahweh's retinue, whose noisy adulation had started at the creation of the world, when the morning stars had sung together and the divine suns had shouted with joy. Ever since, the heavenly chorus praising God's every move had continued to sound. Thanks to the privileged place of melodious chanting, choral singing, and organ music in the religious traditions of the West, we tend to imagine the heavens were filled with the euphonious sound of angelic hymning and close harmony choirs. But the everyday sounds of the ancient heavens tended to be rather more cacophonous. Yahweh himself, of course, was naturally noisy. In the Bible, he could not only be found thundering from his temple, but laughing at human hubris, screaming like a woman in labour as he creates new marvels, whistling up punishing plagues of insects to ravage crops, and singing with unbridled joy at the top of his voice. But his divine attendants were similarly clamorous. The cherubim flanking his throne made quite the racket, for when they moved with God, Their enormous beating wings emitted deafening noises. The roar of a stormy sea, the crash and clamour of battle, the rumble and boom of thunderclaps. The seraphim were little better. When Isaiah sees them in the Jerusalem temple, these winged fiery serpents are busy chanting, "Holy, holy, holy is Yahweh of hosts," as they wheel about God. And yet they're not singing, but shouting, and at such a volume that the very temple shakes. Even away from his sacred buildings, the noise of God and his divine companions could be heard. Later in the book of Isaiah, a prophet among the exiles in far-off Babylon can overhear the conversation between Yahweh and his council of gods in the heavens, who not only talk at considerable volume, but shout blessings to Yahweh's worshippers in the earthly realm below. Loud voices were an asset in a world in which worshippers' music and song enveloped sacred space, filling temples and sanctuaries with a sacral soundtrack, often accompanying the screams of sacrificial animals. Although musical performance in Yahweh's older temples had tended to be a more exclusive activity, likely undertaken by specialised players trained to please the deity in private, communal music took on a more prominent public role from the 5th century BCE onwards, following the rebuilding of the Jerusalem temple. Worshippers and pilgrims alike were enjoined to sing and dance as they praised God with all manner of musical instruments. Praise him with blasts of the horn, praise him with harp and lyre, praise him with timbrel and dance, praise him with strings and pipe, praise him with clanging cymbals, praise him with loud clashing cymbals. Against this sonic backdrop, the music and song of communal worship in the Second Temple era was increasingly understood to be an earthly reflection of the looping soundtrack of the divine realm, where God was now surrounded by the near perpetual sound of the music and song of his divine entourage. As rabbinic legend would later have it, the noise was so constant that God had occasionally felt the need to tell the heavenly host to shut up. "Do not sing today," he had apparently said to the angels as he submerged Egyptians in the Sea of Reeds. "How can I listen to singing when the works of my hands are drowning in the sea?" There was some debate among rabbis as to whether God's call for quiet was motivated by a dignified pang of sympathy for his victims, or a vengeful desire to ensure he could hear their screams as he thrust them under the waters. Either way, God's world had already become so noisy that the seer of the book of Revelation would feel the need to remark that there was silence in heaven for about half an hour, so that God could hear the prayers of the persecuted ascending with the smoke of incense towards his throne. Of course, once the prayers had reached God's ears, the thunder, trumpeting, shouting, roaring, and singing of the heavenly realm began again. No wonder the God of the Bible had occasionally demanded the sound of silence. Given his human-like anatomy, Yahweh's ears were ever open, for not even gods had earlids, which meant he either had to cover them or command quietude if he wanted respite from the clamour of worship. "Take away from me the noise of your songs. I will not listen to the melody of your harps." Yahweh's refusal to listen to songs of praise was often intended to punish his wayward worshippers, but it risked undermining his perceived ability to respond to those in dire need, who were painfully aware that, in covering his ears, God might miss their urgent prayers. "Do not shut your ear to my cry for help, but give me relief," pleaded one fretful petitioner. "Do not hide your face from me in the day of my distress. Incline your ear to me, answer me speedily," begged another. Like his divine peers across the ancient world, Yahweh's hearing was crucial to his social relationships with his worshippers. It was not with his eyes or mouth that he acknowledged his people on a day-to-day basis, a privilege more usually gifted to religious elites, but with his ears, into which the prayers and pleas of his devotees were directed. But those prayers might need help in reaching God's ears. Across ancient Southwest Asia, temple priests offered up daily petitions for the well-being of their local communities, but special requests stood a better chance of being heard if religious specialists could be persuaded to relay the petition to the deity's cult statue. A fleeting detail in the story of Samuel, a legendary prophet from Yahweh's venerable temple in Shiloh, seems to reflect this ritual. Samuel has to repeat the Israelite tribe's noisy appeal for a king directly into Yahweh's ears before the deity can agree to their demands. But one of the most effective ways to target a deity's ears was to turn a petition, prayer, or plea into a sacred object gifted to the god or goddess. In Egypt, for example, these votive offerings often took the form of little models of the deity's ear, or small stelae engraved with godly ears. As Egyptologist Emily Teeter remarks, these objects functioned much like an ancient mobile phone with a dedicated line to the deity. And Yahweh's worshippers were employing similar strategies. Suggestive archaeological evidence comes from the late Persian and Hellenistic periods. For those in and around 4th century BCE Jerusalem, coins marked with Yahweh's ear not only publicized his willingness to listen to his people, but paid to the temple might have been more likely to ensure worshippers' petitions were both heard and seen by the deity himself, just as he is said to have promised Solomon when the Jerusalem temple had first been built. "My eyes will be open and my ears attentive to the prayer from this place." In Yahweh's temple on Mount Gerizim, however, worshippers were more proactive in ensuring their prayers would reach God. Here, in the 2nd century BCE, a man called Deliah was one of many to solidify his personal appeal to Yahweh into a permanent petition by paying for it to be inscribed into the stone brickwork of the sanctuary itself. "This is the stone which Deliah, son of Shimon, offered for himself and his sons, this stone for good remembrance before the God in this place." Deliah was asking Yahweh not to forget about him or his children, which would inevitably bring them misfortune, but to favour them instead with his ongoing care and attention. The inscribed petition transformed the mute brick into a speaking stone, an audio text on constant repeat, serving as a permanent reminder to the deity dwelling in the temple. As far as his worshippers were concerned, confirmation of God's hearing had long been understood to come in the form of an answer to a prayer, recovery from illness perhaps, or a new pregnancy, a successful harvest, or a smooth journey. But an unanswered prayer was not always as easy to identify and understand. Had the deity heard but rejected the petition? Had he listened but forgotten to reply? Or had he missed the prayer altogether? Some shouted their prayers louder, some ritually fasted, and some turned their prayers into mourning, all in the effort to draw the deity's attention to their petition. The anxiety is painfully attested in a heart-wrenching psalm. "My God, my God, why have you forsaken me? Why are you so far away from helping me and from the words of my groaning? Oh, my God, I cry by day, but you do not answer, and by night, but find no rest." In the Gospels of Matthew and Mark, it's the opening line of this extract that is shouted by Jesus as he dies upon the cross. Having offered up prayers to be spared the night before his execution, these early gospel writers are in no doubt their hero felt abandoned by his God. But the psalm itself suggests Yahweh might simply be too far away to hear human noises, which is why he is so often asked in the Hebrew Bible not simply to incline his ear towards his worshippers, but more literally to stretch or extend his ear, much as we might extend our own by cupping a hand or leaning into the direction of a sound we're grasping to hear. God's hearing was superhuman, but it wasn't limitless. It's for this reason that one ancient poet marvels that his distressed cries could reach Yahweh's ears in the heavenly heights of his mountaintop temple. But even inside the building itself, God's hearing could be restricted. As we've already seen, ritual regulations in the book of Exodus reveal that the high priest's robes were fringed with bells, so that as he approached the deity's private room, the Holy of Holies, Yahweh could hear him coming. It was a precautionary measure intended to prevent the god from being so startled or angered by the sudden intrusion that he might attack and kill the priest. But during sustained periods of calamity, when Yahweh appeared to be worryingly ignorant of his worshippers' pleas, The fear arose that he might have gone deaf, a deeply damaging condition for any deity tasked with responding to the voices of their people. "His ear is not too dull to hear," one prophet had found himself insisting to those exiled to Babylonia. But if Yahweh's ears were in good working order, his hearing was clearly selective. According to Genesis, when Abraham's slave wife Hagar was banished to the desert with her son to die, her desperate prayers to God went unheard. Instead, it was the cries of her son the deity could hear, the boy tellingly named Ishmael, "God hears." "What troubles you, Hagar?" says a divine messenger dispatched to her aid. "Do not be afraid, for God has heard the voice of the boy." By contrast, Yahweh's hearing was far sharper when people moaned about him behind his back. The Israelite tribes are said to have grumbled among themselves about the hardships of the journey to the Promised Land, but Yahweh had overheard every word and was livid. "How long shall this wicked congregation complain against me?" he demands of Moses and Aaron. "I have heard the complaints of the Israelites which they complain against me," he says, vowing to kill the naysayers before the journey's end. Theologically, God's ears were particularly sensitive to the sound of insincerity. Those suspected of prayers and rituals empty of conviction were frequently reprimanded. "Look," Yahweh says, with the exasperation of a frazzled parent, "you fast only to quarrel and to fight and to strike with a wicked fist. Such fasting as you do today will not make your voice heard on high." Ostentatious performances of piety similarly rang hollow in God's ears. One group of worshippers soon came to realize their panting, pained petitions had done nothing to gain Yahweh's favor. "Like a woman with child who writhes and cries out in her pangs when she is near her time, so were we," confesses one poet. "We were with child, we writhed, but we gave birth only to wind." Subsequent generations of prophets and rabbis would similarly warn against flatulent faith, including, apparently, Jesus of Nazareth, who is reported to have said, "When you're praying, do not heap up empty phrases as the Gentiles do, for they think that they will be heard because of their many words." God's aversion to excessive human noise was not simply a matter of religious propriety. It was an inherited condition, shared by almost all deities. Across ancient Southwest Asia, the gods were naturally unsettled by loud noises emanating from other beings in the cosmos, be it the roar of an unruly monster, the ironclad sound of an army, or the rumble of complaints from their worshippers. But some sounds were simply unbearable because they were so distressing. A particularly poignant example occurs in a Mesopotamian incantation invoking the high god Anu and his wife and consort Antu. It was to be recited 3 times by parents desperate to calm the cries of their newborn baby. "Why does he scream until his mother sobs, till in heaven Antu herself is in tears? Who is this that makes such a racket on earth? If it's a dog, someone give it food. If it's a bird, someone fling a clod at it. If it's a human child that's angry, someone cast a spell of Anu and Antu over him. Let his father lie down to get the rest of his sleep. Let his mother, who has her chores to do, get her chores done." The noise of a crying baby disturbed the gods in more ways than one. Like us, they felt the double-edged stab of compassion and frustration at the sound of an infant's unexplained distress, and they too worried it signalled the onset of illness, although they were more likely to assume its cause was a baby-maiming demon rather than colic. But the gods were also highly attuned to a baby's cry because it announced the ongoing multiplication of humans in the earthly realm. And more humans invariably meant a greater risk of overpopulation, draining the fragile Earth's resources and the consequent rise of disobedience and disorder in the cosmos. According to some Mesopotamian traditions, the gods had necessarily been forced to create barrenness, disease, famine, flood, and deadly demons in an effort to control human numbers. In the Bible, echoes of this mythic mindset can be heard in God's hypersensitivity to the noise of humans busy with their own affairs rather than his. Prophetic oracles threaten unruly communities not only with infertility, famine, disease, and death, but with the cessation of the very sounds of human fertility and fruitfulness, from the voices of a newlywed couple and the cry of a baby, to the clamour of loud singing and drunken parties celebrating the harvests. God's episodic culling of human fruitfulness might have been spun as a punishment for religious misdemeanours, but it also helpfully silenced the racket mortal productivity created. In the ears of the deity, the din of an emboldened humanity was dangerously akin to the tumultuous, rebellious upsurge of the waters of chaos and regularly needed muffling. You silence the roaring of the seas, the roaring of their waves, the tumult of the peoples, one psalmist enthusiastically acknowledges. Indeed, among God's creatures, there were none louder than those industrious city-dwelling humans, whose noisy activities threatened to overwhelm the heavens were they not kept in check. Crowd control was essential, as the biblical story about the Tower of Babel illustrates. In the very distant past, so the story goes, all humans shared one language, enabling them to gang together to build themselves a city with a tower high enough to access the heavenly realm. Seemingly unnerved, Yahweh descended from the heavens to inspect the new construction and report back to the divine council. "Look," he said, "they are one people and they all have one language, and this is only the beginning of what they might do. Nothing that they propose to do will now be impossible for them." The only solution was to restrict the extent to which humans could communicate and cooperate with one another. "Come, let us go down and confuse their language there so that they will not understand one another's speech," Yahweh instructed. At Babel, human voices were to become a background babble, noisy but neutered. Eye of the Beholder. Across ancient Southwest Asia, artisans richly tasked with bringing the god's statues into being used an age-old technique to capture the eyes of the divine. Set within almond-shaped ivory or alabaster, the huge irises of the god's eyes were crafted from precious materials imbued with the divine hues of the primeval cosmos: onyx, obsidian, or lapis lazuli. Polished to an iridescent shine, the dark eyes of the divine glistened, their gaze intensified by the thick eyeliner, often a matching strip of gemstone, edging their upper and lower lids. Powerful incantations were whispered to the statue, inviting its newly resident deity to open the eyes so that the gleam of the irises was no longer the lustre of stone or glass, but the shine of eyes alive with divinity. Literary reflections of God's glistening eyes can be glimpsed in the Bible, and in a poem that was already very ancient when it was appended to an early form of Deuteronomy, we suddenly get a vivid close-up of one of his eyeballs. It briefly looms into view in a description of Yahweh looking after his baby son Jeshurun, representing Israel, in the wilderness, although English translations can often obscure it. In the New Revised Standard Version of the Bible, for example, we read that God guarded him as the apple of his eye. This standard translation replaces an old Hebrew idiom with an English alternative, so that the baby boy is described as the apple of God's eye, a metaphorical reference to the eye's pupil. But although the English expression captures the intensity of God's love for Jeshurun, it masks the anatomical dynamics of the Hebrew idiom itself, which refers to the eye's pupil as the little man, a vivid allusion to the tiny reflection we can see of ourselves when we look closely into someone's eyes. Translated more carefully, this ancient poem portrays the deity gazing at his baby so intently that the boy is imprinted onto God's shiny black pupil. He watched him as the little man in his eye. A similar expression is used of the people of Israel in a much later biblical book, in which Yahweh promises his worshippers that he will destroy any invader who would despoil their land. Truly, one who touches you touches the little child in my eye. For God, the plundering of his people was akin to a poke in the eye. But God's language in this text went beyond metaphor. His eyes were not simply seeing organs, but feeling organs. And in this, he was no different from mortals. In a post-enlightenment world, we're accustomed to setting our sense of sight within a context of spatial and conceptual distance. What we see is either near or far from us, and it remains separate from us. Our eyes have become corporeal cameras, rendering our optic lenses panes of glass through which we view the outside world. But in ancient Southwest Asian cultures, as in many others, seeing was not a remote, objective process operating distinctively or independently of the body's other senses. Instead, it was perceived as a reflexive, haptic, or tactile sensation. The eyes could receptively feel what was seen and actively affect or touch what they saw. Seeing and being seen were bodily encounters, rendering visual contact a form of physical contact, especially when seeing took on the intensity of looking or gazing. These visual dynamics pervade the Bible. In Genesis, for example, Noah is the victim of a palpable visual assault. Sprawled naked in his tent after a drinking session, he's oblivious to his son, Ham, looking at his nakedness or genitals. It's tantamount to Ham touching his father's penis, an illicit act his brothers are so keen to avoid that when they hasten into the tent to throw a garment over Noah, they not only avert their eyes, but walk backwards. Sober, Noah senses he has been physically violated. Noah awoke from his wine and he knew what his youngest son had done to him. This is the crime that had led Noah to curse the fruit of Ham's own loins. Anxieties about tactile vision cluster about women's bodies in the Bible too. In several passages across both the Hebrew Bible and New Testament, the veiling of women often serves a protective function, shielding them from the penetrating touch of the violating male gaze, even when it came from the heavens, as Paul appears to suggest when he insists women should cover their heads on account of the angels who had been known to take a dangerous fancy to mortal women in the distant past. Even the famous story of Doubting Thomas, which seems so concerned with physical touch, plays on the notion that the eyes were tactile organs. When the risen Jesus suddenly materialises before the disciples, Thomas cannot believe Christ's body is the same fleshy form that was crucified. "Put your finger here and see my hands. Reach out your hand and put it in my side," Jesus says, inviting him to touch his wounds. Contrary to centuries of Christian art showing Thomas sticking his finger into a gaping hole in Jesus' torso, he is not said to touch him with his hands at all. Instead, he uses his eyes to feel. Looking at the wounds appears to confirm for Thomas the reality of the resurrected body. His astounded gasp, "My Lord and my God," prompting Jesus to ask, "Have you believed because you have seen me?" Something of the divine power of heavenly beings and sacred objects could be absorbed or imprinted into the body via the eyes of those lucky enough to gaze upon them. Following Yahweh's careful instructions, Moses makes a bronze figurine of a snake and sets it up as a cult statue so that whenever a serpent bit someone, that person would look at the serpent of bronze and live. Elijah's numinous power can only be transferred onto Elisha's body when Elisha watches him ascending into the heavens as a divinized being. And when Moses sees God on Sinai, of course, his face acquires something of God's own features, prompting him to veil himself from the eyes of the Israelites when he descends back into the ordinary world. If mortal eyes could touch what they saw, so too could those of the gods. Casting their eyes over the earthly realm, deities looked upon their favoured peoples with a benevolent, life-giving gaze, so that fields and farms were rendered fertile, streams and rivers teemed with life, and cities prospered. Under their watchful care, humanity could physically flourish. As the patron deity of the Israelites, Yahweh's eyes were naturally fixed on the land he had given them, a land of hills and valleys watered by rain from the heavens, a land that Yahweh your God surveys. The eyes of Yahweh your God are always on it from the beginning of the year to the end of the year. Underlying this vivid image of God's gaze watering the land was the fundamental idea that in both gods and mortals, the cranium was a well of water, rendering each eye a spring. And in Hebrew, the word ayin means both eye and spring. By looking upon the land, Yahweh's watery eyes fructified its soil. The fertile touch of God's gaze naturally extended beyond the vista of the undulating landscape. Like most deities, Yahweh was also equipped with supersight. But while the all-encompassing vision of other gods like Marduk and Ishtar was occasionally manifest in the doubling of their eyes, Yahweh's anatomy remained human-like. He had the standard two eyes, but they were telescopic. From a divine distance, the world's human inhabitants might have been like grasshoppers to God, as a verse in Isaiah puts it, but he could zoom in on the minutiae of human life, scrutinizing mortal bodies with an impressive attention to detail. And that included taking note of whether or not his male worshippers were circumcised. As Yahweh tells Abraham in Genesis, the mark of circumcision was to be a sign for the deity himself, a visual aid memoir akin to the rainbow sign he set in the skies after the flood, reminding Yahweh of his covenantal promise to bless his male worshippers with children, thereby perpetuating their dynastic line. When his worshippers had sex, Yahweh would look upon the circumcised penis and recall his promise, his fertile gaze supercharging the organ as it did its work. The God of the Bible appears not to have looked quite as carefully at women's reproductive organs, which is hardly surprising given the androcentrism of the biblical writers. Having taken on the role of divine midwife, God's gynecological interests tended to be limited to opening the womb to form and deliver a child, should he so choose. And it was the child on whom he fixed his eyes. Switching from supersight to X-ray vision, he looked through the wall of the womb, and often well past the mother, to focus on the fetus itself, his watchful gaze moulding the indistinct creature into a full-term baby, as one overwhelmed psalmist exclaims. It was you who formed my inward parts. You knit me together in my mother's womb. My frame was not hidden from you when I was being made in secret, intricately woven in the depths of the earth. Your eyes beheld my unformed substance. On one of the rare occasions when the God of the Bible did look more closely at women rather than looking through them, he still failed to see them properly. His eyes were caught only by the erotic sensuality of their bodies and the dangerous power of their own gaze. They walk with outstretched necks, glancing wantonly with their eyes, mincing along as they go, tinkling with their feet, he says, scowling at the women of Jerusalem in the book of Isaiah. It was a sight that irritated his masculinist, sensitive eyes, so much so that as he glares at them, he envisages searing their hair from their heads and their genitalia, leaving them violated and exposed. The Lord will afflict with scabs the heads of the daughters of Zion. Yahweh will lay bare their private parts. This horrific image is immediately followed by a warning that those women who draw attention to themselves with cosmetics will be dehumanized. They will be stripped, shaved, and trussed up as slaves. Instead of perfume, there will be a stench, and instead of a sash, a rope, God growls. Instead of well-set hair, baldness, and instead of a rich robe, a binding of sackcloth. Instead of beauty, shame. By stark contrast, male beauty triggered a very different response. Across much of the ancient world, the physical charms of a good-looking man were proof that he was favoured in the eyes of the gods, his features reflexively manifesting the blessings imparted by the enraptured stare of a smitten deity. And Yahweh appears to have been no different. In the biblical story explaining how Saul came to be the first king of the Israelites, his staggering good looks are cited as proof of Yahweh's favour. No man was more handsome or taller, for he quite literally stood head and shoulders above everyone else. He had clearly been chosen to reign by God himself. And yet, as we've already seen, when the gorgeous teenage David caught Yahweh's eye, the deity's head was easily turned, and the Israelites would have a new king. Saul was fated to be cut down to size. He will die on his knees on the battlefield, where his corpse will be decapitated, stripped, and hung up on a city wall, his headless, naked torso transformed into a monstrous grotesque. Of course, Yahweh denied that David was chosen to replace Saul solely because of his looks. What was on the inside counted, too. "Do not look on his appearance or on the height of his stature," Yahweh had said to Samuel as the faithful prophet was busy trying to establish exactly which beautiful boy Yahweh had selected to take Saul's place. "Yahweh does not see as mortals see. They look on the outward appearance, but Yahweh looks on the heart," the deity had claimed. God's X-ray vision gave him a piercing insight into whomever he chose to probe. Like a diviner examining the innards of a sacrificial animal, God scrutinized the cognitive workings of the heart and the emotional heft of the liver and bowel, reading the hidden recesses of a person to discern between the virtuous and the villainous. His eyes behold, his eyelids scrutinize humankind. Yahweh examines the righteous and the wicked. In the stillness of the night, the devout could call on God in their prayers, inviting him to inspect them from head to toe, inside and out. "From your face let my judgment come, let your eyes behold my righteousness. If you probe my heart, if you visit me by night, if you test me, you will find no wickedness in me. My mouth does not transgress. My steps have held fast to your paths, my feet have not stumbled. Watch over me as the little man reflected in the eye." For some worshippers, God's scrutiny was a wondrous, comforting encounter with a watchful, caring deity. For others, however, it was a brutal, bodily invasion, akin to a demonic attack. Double vision. Under God's unrelenting gaze, Job's skin burns, blisters, and peels. His flesh disintegrates, his organs split and leak, his bones threaten to splinter and shatter. He's plagued with terrifying visions and monstrous nightmares. Job decides he's had enough of living, and he's had enough of God's suffocating scrutiny. "Will you not look away from me for a while?" he begs his divine tormentor. "You do not leave me alone while I swallow my spit. What sin have I done to you, you watcher of humanity? Why have you made me your target?" As readers, we're in on God's game, a heavenly wager that no matter the injustice and severity of his afflictions, Job will not curse God. We know Job's suffering is a false punishment for a non-existent sin. Like Job himself, we know he is innocent of any wrongdoing. And so does God. And yet still Job suffers as God's eyes eat into his body, slowly devouring him in a thoroughly corporeal way. "He has gnashed his teeth at me, my adversary sharpens his eyes against me. He slashes open my kidneys and shows no mercy. He has poured my gall out on the ground." God had become demonic. When the bulk of the book of Job was composed, probably sometime in the late 5th or early 4th century BCE, malevolent demons were the more usual culprits of supernatural attacks. Like monsters, they were either servants of the gods or rebels against divine order. Whether they were dispatched from the heavens by an irritated deity, or came from the wilderness, the underworld, or a sorcerer's spellbook, these vicious beings delighted in spreading sickness and disease, ravaging crops, and stealing the lives of new mothers and their babies. Some demons fell under the command of deities of plague and pestilence. Others were disembodied manifestations of hidden, noxious elements running riot in the cosmos, including destructive emotions emanating from the bodies of gods and mortals alike, the most common of which was the evil eye. A malicious look or an envious stare could conjure the evil eye into being, bringing the object of the ravenous gaze into its line of vision. Its victims could feel the bite or sting in their bodies and in their pockets. The beautiful might experience hair loss. The affluent might find their rich food made them sick or their fine clothes made their skin flake. Landowners could discover that their vineyards had been attacked by insects. Farmers that livestock had been mysteriously let loose from their pens. But a more studied, sinister stare could bring about far more serious symptoms. Pregnant women might miscarry, newborns might die, and the outright cursed could find their bodies starting to rot like a corpse, much like Job. The close association of the evil eye with corrosive emotions like greed, envy, and spite also rendered it internally damaging to those who triggered it, so that they might be eaten away on the inside should they not guard against it. Distinguishing between a straightforward demonic attack and the scourge of the evil eye was not always easy, but protection from both came in the form of amulets, which were worn on the body, attached to the windows and doorways of the home, and accompanied the dead into their tombs. The most common was the Utjet amulet, better known today as the Eye of Horus, which in Egypt harnessed the health and protection of the falcon-eyed god Horus, but across the Levant and Mesopotamia had come to manifest the watchful gaze of benevolent deities guarding their worshippers. Whether engraved on small terracotta plaques or wrought from semi-precious stones or ivory, Utjet amulets brought the eyes of a god, edged with thick liner, into the earthly realm. For both gods and mortals, kohl eyeliner was itself an important magical tool against both the evil eye and the dangerous, penetrating stare of others. In emphasizing and enlarging the eyes, it simultaneously strengthened the gaze and repelled the glare of another. The heavily lined, unblinking gaze of Yahweh had long been understood to watch over his worshippers, protecting them from harm and misfortune. In the biblical imagination, the huge apotropaic eyes of God had not only looked down on the strange land of Canaan when the Israelites had first arrived, but more recently, the eye of God had watched over those elders who had eventually returned to Jerusalem from exile in Babylonia, as though it were suspended in the skies like a celestial amulet. But in the latter half of the first millennium BCE, as Yahweh's pantheon shrank and his portfolio of divine roles and functions correspondingly grew more expansive, discerning between the evil eye and the punishing, penetrating gaze of God became more difficult. Demons had long been known to roam through the mortal world, and now God's eyes increasingly did the same. In biblical texts from this later period, his seemingly disembodied eyeballs roved over the earth, his deadly glance flickering over humans, darting about, looking for misdemeanors so that he could fix them with a withering gaze. This is the deity who sets his sights on the protagonist of the book of Job. Stripped of his wealth, health, and children, but not his furious wife, Job is left with nothing but the heap of dung on which he sits. As he scrapes the sores from his skin with a broken piece of pot, his friends insist he's either suffering the consequences of unconfessed offences or he's been afflicted by demons. But throughout the book, Job knows he is under attack from the eyes of God himself. As he says to his nameless wife, "Shall we receive the good from God and not receive the bad?" If Yahweh was a sovereign deity from whom all favour and misfortune equally came, his capacity for harm, whether serious or slight, was not only a theological certainty, but an evident reality in the day-to-day lives of his worshippers. But not everyone was comfortable with this position, as the book of Job itself attests. A second writer has appended a narrative introduction to its cycle of poems, reasserting the active presence of junior gods in Yahweh's divine council, and casting one of its members as the Satan, the accuser, a title rather than the name of a heavenly being appointed to bring charges of religious disobedience against mortals. It's the Satan who not only incites Yahweh to violence, as the deity himself claims, but is also directly responsible for attacking Job. Combining the roving gait of a bog-standard demon with the scrutinizing, all-seeing eyes of God himself, it is now the Satan who roams about Job's world, looking out for wrongdoing and punishing those who have sinned. He may have been a heavenly agent of God, but in the book of Job, the Satan served as a useful theological buffer between an all-seeing, all-powerful deity and the injustices of inexplicable human suffering. Distancing God from his more malevolent attributes would not only give rise to a new satanic force in the cosmos, but would also give new life to evil. Although the God of the Bible had rid himself of the other high gods in his pantheon, he had retained the services of its lowest-ranking members, his divine messengers. But from about the 3rd century BCE, they began to undergo a process of reinvention within certain circles. The anonymous divine messengers of old were soon a hierarchical organization of angelic beings, headed by powerful archangels with distinct roles and personalities, most prominently Michael, Gabriel, and Raphael. By means of a similar process, those scattered demons and malevolent forces which had long plagued humans, including the evil eye, were increasingly grouped together as a task force of evil capable of invading mortal bodies and inciting humans to sin. By the 1st century BCE, they were operating under the command of various supernatural adversaries of God, chief among them Belial, Mastema, and the Satan himself, who had been relocated from the heavenly realm to a sinister wasteland at the edges of the cosmos. Not that most Yahweh worshippers were aware of the complexities of this cosmology. While angels and demons naturally continued to populate the religious landscape, an overtly dualistic worldview was not a widespread feature of ancient Jewish speculation. Instead, it was a specialist development within certain scribal circles and a prominent feature of apocalyptic groups who were convinced that end times were approaching when the final battle between good and evil would be fought. By the end of the 1st century CE, these apocalyptic groups had come to include some of Jesus' devotees, many of whom held that humans were not only naturally inclined towards wrongdoing, but dangerously vulnerable to demon-induced sin from which only Christ could deliver them. Against this shifting religious backdrop, the eyes of God had taken on a different hue. Culturally, the eye had already come to be perceived as an organ of light, much as it was in the Greek world. Like a little sun or a burning lamp, it emitted fiery rays of light that would touch whatever was in their path and transport its imprinted image back to the eye. As the historian Ruth Bielefeld puts it, to see was to shine. Healthy eyes were those which shone and sparkled, while damaged eyes were dull and devoid of light. Among God's worshippers, physical health was closely tied to spiritual health, so that the very optics of human righteousness and sinfulness were now coded in the same way. The bright eyes of the devout were physically and spiritually enlightened, while those who evil-eyed others with a look of greed, envy, or spite emitted not light, but darkness. As Jesus is reported to have said, repeating what was by then traditional Jewish teaching, "The eye is the lamp of the body. So if your eye is healthy, your whole body will be full of light. But if your eye is evil, your whole body will be full of darkness." It was better to rip out the evil eye than to risk the horrifying prospect of God's coming judgment, when the whole body would burn for eternity in the fires of Gehenna, a mythological place drawn on Jerusalem's Hinnom Valley, in Hebrew Gehinnom, which had once been an entryway into the underworld, but would later come to be known as hell. If the look of evil was darkness, God's gaze was now quite the opposite. His eyes blazed with a fiery light. According to the Book of Sirach, his eyes were 10,000 times brighter than the sun. When Enoch had ascended into the heavens, it was said, he was overwhelmed when he locked eyes with God. I have seen the Lord's eyes shining like the sun's rays and filling the eyes of a man with awe, he exclaimed. For most Jewish communities in the Greco-Roman world, God's watchful gaze was akin to the sun in the heavens, remotely surveying the world below with an all-seeing eye of warm benevolence or scorching heat as he meted out justice. But for those groups seized by a more eschatological or apocalyptic vision of the cosmos, including the earliest devotees of Christ, God's eyes were deadly. A mystical vision enshrined in the Book of Daniel had described the archangels of a coming cosmic judgment as having eyes like flaming torches. And now, God's eyes also burned with fire. In the book of Revelation, these are the eyes of the heavenly Christ and his army of archangels who will destroy all those in the grip of Satan. Flaming eyes had once been a distinctive anatomical feature of primeval cosmic monsters and dangerous demons, their burning, noxious gaze repelled only by the dark, coal-lined eyes of the watchful gods. But now, God's eyes embodied the terrifying gaze, so that even his most faithful servants could no longer look upon him. As one ancient Jewish mystic would later put it, no eyes of any being are able to gaze at him, neither eyes of flesh and blood nor the eyes of his heavenly attendants. For if anyone were to look at him, God's eyes would discharge and bring forth torches of fire, scorching and burning him. His gleaming lapis lazuli eyes and reflective black pupils had disappeared. Instead, God's eyes were now balls of fire, distancing him ever further from the world of his worshippers.